Mr. Brockman.
May it please the court. The proceedings in the district court below seek to obtain and have for now several years encumbered funds that are held by the Maryland State Treasury. The district court erred in entertaining those proceedings to garnish property held by the state after the state had moved to quash the writ. That's because the proceedings at issue are ones to which the federal judicial power, in the words of the 11th Amendment, does not extend. Core principles of sovereign immunity embodied in the 11th Amendment place limitations on the federal judicial power, and the district court transgressed those limitations. At the same time, the district court transgressed limitations imposed by Maryland law, which is incorporated into Rule 69, and which forbids the attachment of assets held by the state, its agencies, and its officials. So the district court twice erred in allowing the plaintiffs to maintain the garnishment action. The district court seemingly thought that this was not the typical 11th Amendment case. In fact, it's the quintessential 11th Amendment case. In the words of this court, in the case I think the plaintiffs rely most heavily on, the In Re NDR bankruptcy case, this court recognized that the attributes of a suit that falls within the 11th Amendment bar are ones where the state is named and required to submit to the jurisdiction of the court, and where and especially ones where money is sought from the state treasury. So the
is this an in rem proceeding?
Under Maryland law, it's not considered a purely in rem proceeding.
Is it a quasi in rem proceeding?
I think they're both in personam and in rem issues for jurisdiction. There's a recent opinion by Judge Grimm that addresses garnishment under Maryland law that looks at the sort of personal jurisdiction question. But I don't think it matters for the 11th Amendment analysis here. And it doesn't matter for the Maryland law analysis. The Constitution protects Maryland's right not to be hailed into federal court without its consent to answer a writ of garnishment. And the Maryland law that governs the garnishment proceeding, as I said, reinforces that protection because the writ just simply does not lie to attach state funds.
I'm reading from a Maryland case noting, I believe, that garnishment proceedings commence proceeding as in rem or quasi in rem.
That may be. As I said, I recall reading recently a Judge Grimm, an opinion by Judge Grimm that went very thoroughly into the subject. Go ahead.
No, please.
But perhaps I can address the question. I don't know exactly what the significance would be.
Right. And the reason I asked is that in looking at sovereign immunity, the Supreme Court has held that under bankruptcy law, a proceeding to set aside a transfer isn't barred by the 11th Amendment because bankruptcy is in rem and doesn't implicate state sovereignty to the same degree.
Well, as I understand, perhaps Your Honor is referring to the Katz Central Virginia Community mm-hmm. College case.
Yes.
Yeah, and which means that the In Re NVR analysis and Antonelli and some of the cases that were decided in the late 90s around this, still in the recent aftermath of Seminole Tribe, no longer apply in the bankruptcy context because now it's understood that the states have no immunity to bankruptcy proceedings. But that's because in the Katz analysis, there's an implicit waiver. There has to either be abrogation or waiver. There's waiver, and it's implicit in the constitutional design. That was the analysis that I think Justice Stevens put forth in the Katz case. So we can put bankruptcy to one side, and I don't think its in rem character is necessarily the clincher there. It's that
well, it certainly was in part based on the character of a bankruptcy proceeding as an in rem proceeding?
Yeah. The race here is money held by the state.
This would be the case whenever the 11th Amendment.
Precisely.
Right.
Right. I mean, whether it's garnishment or a tort claim, Section 1983 suit, we're talking about money held by the state, whether it's a contract action. Here, the garnishor, the judgment creditor, step in the shoes of the judgment debtor. The judgment debtor, putting aside for the moment the fact that we don't actually have a judgment debtor whose assets the state holds, they're distinct juror entities, but judgment debtor would be able to, the LLC here, would be able to bring a contract claim against the state, but only in state court, and only because the state has waived its immunity and limited it to state court and
right.
otherwise limited it. So it's the same money we're talking about, and the same analysis should apply. Every other element of the coercive process of a judicial tribunal that the Supreme Court has found to be sort of the touchstone of this analysis is present here. The writ of garnishment is initiated by the service of a writ that must be served in the same manner as a summons and complaint in an ordinary civil action. It compels, in this case, the state to come into federal court and to answer the writ upon pain of default in a default judgment. State does not submit to the court's jurisdiction, it runs that risk, a default judgment. If it does submit to the court's jurisdiction, it runs the risk of discovery and a jury trial, and, as in this case, prolonged motions practice to resolve threshold questions about whether these assets are really even part of the judgment debtor's assets,
or right.
ones and to which the judgment debtor has a claim. I'm sorry.
The district court agreed with you on that point, that the proceeding appears to be a suit in the procedural sense.
That's right. And the district court also acknowledged that it does involve extracting money from the state treasury. So either one of those acknowledgments would be sufficient to resolve the 11th Amendment question in our favor. It's clear under
Well, not entirely. I mean, that just looks at whether or not it's a suit. The question is also, is it a suit against the state of Maryland?
Well, it clearly is. Mm-hmm. The state is the named defendant. It's we don't care whether we're called a respondent, complainant, respondent, petitioner, respondent, plaintiff, defendant, or here garnishee versus garnishor. The writ and the adjudication of it work just the same. And the affront to the state's dignity of having to be held into another sovereign's courts
but
is the
to
same.
But to the extent that it's a suit against Maryland, it's only as a custodian.
Well, that seems to have been the district court's theory and the principal theory advanced by the plaintiffs in this appeal, this mere custodian theory, which seems to be derived from a case from the Ninth Circuit 30 years ago.
How is that inaccurate?
Well, it's either completely accurate and then pointless, or it's inaccurate. It's either completely accurate, as I say, because the state is the custodian of lots of funds. That's what the Treasury is. But it's not as though we're running a safe deposit box operation here. This is money that the state uses. It spends it on services, benefits, programs, contractors, and vendors. It's creditors. So it's always using the money for something, and that's true when it's a defendant in a tort suit. So
would the money be otherwise available to you?
I'm sorry?
Would the money at issue be otherwise available to you? Could you use it in any manner that you chose?
Well, yes. I mean, at some level. Here, there's a purchase order, and so there's a budget item that allowed the Department of Health to do things. I mean, here they were having the roof repaired on the on a building on the premises of a psychiatric hospital grounds. It's you know, this is not as though the state has cheated abandoned property and it's just waiting for the rightful owner to come and claim it. And in that case, the state only takes custody, not title. So that might be a closer case to actually call this a mere custodian situation. And I think significantly, I mean, the same rule that Maryland applies, the federal government applies, goes back to Buchanan versus Alexander, and it's recognized there to be of even more ancient origin. And the case law has allowed entities that are more properly viewed as custodians, that are not the federal government, but are administering funds in connection with a government program, to resist a garnishment action and do so by asserting sovereign immunity. So even those entities that are not sovereigns but are and really are custodians get the benefit of this rule, and there's no reason that the state should not.
It goes a little bit further under Seminole Tribe by the Supreme Court, 517 U.S. 44 at 58, 1996, that they made it clear that the plaintiff suing a state is irrelevant to the question whether the suit is barred by the 11th Amendment. The court held the 11th Amendment does not exist solely in order to prevent a federal court judgment that may be paid out of the state's treasury. It also serves to avoid the indignity of subjecting a state to the coercive process of judicial tribunals at the instance of private parties.
That's exactly right, and I think in the portion you just referred to, what the Supreme Court actually says is we have often made it clear that the release sought by a plaintiff is irrelevant to the 11th Amendment analysis. And it is. That it's clear that Pennhurst says it regardless of the relief sought and applies whenever the state or one of its agencies or departments is sued. The language of the 11th Amendment says any suit in law or equity. You know, on the other side, as the district court acknowledged, this is a suit for to extract money from the state treasury. On page 59 of the appendix, there's a check from the treasurer of the state of Maryland, I think representing the first installment of the payment on the contract. That's where the money comes from, and any proceeding, regardless of the form or caption, regardless of whether the state is itself named as a party that seeks to get money from the Treasury, is also barred by the 11th Amendment. So on either of those grounds, both of which are present here, the 11th Amendment clearly applies.
Well, but Katz was decided 10 years after Seminole Tribe and appears to backtrack, at least with respect to in rem proceedings.
What's the name of that case?
Central Virginia Community College versus Katz. And that was the basis for my line of questioning.
Okay. In 2006 or 2005, the states all filed amicus briefs urging the court to stick with the direction we thought we'd perceived since Seminole Tribe. So in some sense, this is a retreat.
You concede that this issue is governed by state law?
I'm sorry?
Are you conceding that this issue is governed by state law?
Well, the question of 11th Amendment immunity is governed by federal law. The question of the scope of the Rule 69 procedures and whether they can be used to attach state funds is governed by Maryland law under Rule 69. The Lee Thomas versus Prince George's County decision cited in our brief, for the standard of review, but a relatively recent decision from this court gets into a lengthy analysis and a debate between the dissent and the majority, but both sides agree that the question of 11th Amendment immunity is a federal law question. The question of whether the state has waived it can be a state law question, to which, in that case, this court deferred to the state court.
Is there any evidence in this case that the state has waived sovereign immunity?
No. There was a suggestion in the district court that by waiving its protection from garnishment for wages, mm-hmm. it had relaxed its immunity. That suggestion is correct. It just doesn't apply here.
Well, along those lines, the plaintiff has asserted that Maryland admitted that it owes any, it owes payment to Tao. Is that in the record?
Well, I think the record contradicts that. What the department has admitted is that it owes and will pay when these assets are unfrozen, the LLC. Now, the LLC is not the judgment debtor, and that the issue of whether it can be made to answer for the debts of the judgment debtor is one that the district court has stayed at the request of the plaintiffs here. But we, it's our position that we should not have to hold our assets and have the conduct of public affairs disrupted while those kinds of issues get worked out between private parties whose dispute, you know, we really don't have an interest in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Esters?
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Brian Esters. I'm here today on behalf of the appellees, the Carpenters Pension Funds et al.
Could you speak a little? Sir. I was having trouble hearing you. Thank you.
Basically, the issue here is whether or not this garnishment action, naming the state as garnishee, is truly an action against the state. Because not all proceedings that involve a state are necessarily ones that the 11th Amendment apply to.
Well, let's start with, is it a proceeding?
Yes. Okay, it is a proceeding, but I do not believe it is a proceeding against the state. Okay. While I realize the district court did seem to concede that it was a proceeding against the state, I do not believe that that is even correct.
Okay.
The reason for that is, pursuant to Rule 69A, the applicable procedure is Maryland's Rule 2-645. Rule 2645G states that the proceeding against the garnishee does not rise to the level of a civil action between the judgment creditor and the garnishee unless and until there is a dispute. Basically, until the garnishee states that they either don't owe the money or they don't have as much as what is believed, and then that answer is then disputed by the judgment creditor. At that point, it does become an action against the state, and at that point, 11th Amendment sovereign immunity would become applicable. But prior to that point, when there is no dispute about whether or not the money is held, it's not truly an action against the state. They're really, at that point, procedurally just a custodian.
And are you familiar with the decision of the Department of the Army versus Blue Fox, Inc.?
I'm sorry, one more time?
The Department of the Army versus Blue Fox, Inc. was decided by Justice Rehnquist in 1999. You familiar with that decision?
I am not.
Well, he cites some authority from the Buchanan case, which was an 1846 case. And basically, what he says is that the Blue Fox case is in accord with our precedent establishing that sovereign immunity bars creditors from attaching or garnishing funds in the Treasury.
I am familiar with the Buchanan case.
How do you get around that?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. In that case, that was a case, again, from the mid-1800s. And that deals with the substantive nature of...
Now, Blue Fox was a 1999 case.
Correct.
He applied the case from 1846.
Correct. Well, a lot of these cases, when it's talking about money in the state's treasury, I believe it's more complicated than just that. A lot of cases where there is a garnishment against the state, there is a reasonable expectation that the state may retain an interest, a future interest in the money. Be it because the judgment debtor has disclaimed an interest, or because the money is merely appropriated and the state could change its mind, essentially, and not pay the judgment debtor without incurring liability. That's not the case here. In this case, the money is owed pursuant to a contract that had been performed and is no longer executory. There is no claim that the state of Maryland has that it will, in any way, shape, or form, retain a future interest in the money. All that is at issue is whom the state will pay. And if they don't pay the judgment creditors or the plaintiffs in this matter, they acknowledge that they will pay the LLC. So that's the big difference, is that the state doesn't retain an interest. And while technically it is in the Treasury, under modern accounting principles, this is no longer considered really an asset. On the balance sheet, this would be under the liabilities column of the state.
Mr. Esters, yeah. The state has waived its sovereign immunity with respect to wages, correct? Under principles of statutory construction, aren't waivers of sovereign immunity strictly construed?
Oh, yes.
So if it's waived its sovereign immunity with respect to wage earners, would we not infer that it has not waived its sovereign immunity with respect to the kind of creditor you have here?
I understand and appreciate your question. That waiver of the sovereign immunity, that's that deals with the state's public policy against attachments of funds held in the hands of the state or public officials. I believe there's a case cited in the briefs, the MTA versus Hooper. That case basically discusses how the sovereign immunity, that this is basically a public policy issue, and the waiver of sovereign immunity is such that it deals with the sovereign immunity within the state's own courts. Basically, it says when they are able to be held, brought into court in its own state. It's different than the 11th Amendment immunity, which requires that truly it be a suit against the state. And in this case, again, procedurally, it is not a suit against the state.
And just one more factual question. Sure. And you may have answered this, in the record, is it clear from the record that the department owes this money and will pay it to the LLC?
I believe that is correct. The only question that remains is whether or not the LLC is an alter ego of Tau, the judgment debtor, and that question is still open in the district court.
Well, but it either is or it isn't. It either is clear in the record or it's not clear in the record.
Well, the answer is yes. The reason it's clear in the record is in the state's motion to quash. They filed a memorandum in support, and in that memorandum, they did acknowledge that they owe the debt of $9,000 and some dollars to the LLC. So, yes.
Thank you.
Okay. But again, back to the procedural issues at hand. I think that there is an interesting an analysis that can be considered when looking at an analogous situation of removal doctrine. If this the roles were slightly different, and if it were a federal sovereign entity that were named as a garnishee in a state court, and there was no dispute over whether or not the money was owed to the named judgment debtor, the federal entity would not be able to remove the action to federal court because it truly would not be an action against the state. That issue did come up in the Northern District of Georgia. This was not a case cited in the briefs. I apologize, but I did just recently come across it. I have a case cite for you on that. It's West versus West, 402 F sup 1189, and that's from 1975. So in those instances, it procedurally was not found to be an action against the sovereign, and it was not one that was able to be removed. And also, interestingly, I know the state makes mention of the fact that a failure under the Maryland statute to file an answer could result in a default judgment. That was also the case in Georgia under the Georgia statute in that West v. West case. And in a footnote, the Northern District of Georgia said that the United States' fear of its own negligence, basically fear of not responding, was not sufficient to convert the action into a claim against the state. So for those reasons, it's both procedurally not an action against the state, and as we were discussing previously, substantively here, since the state claims no future interest in the assets, it's not really an asset of the state. The state is merely a custodian and a stakeholder, much like was described in the In Re Visiting Homes Services case from the Ninth Circuit. Additionally, the state has discussed the public policy issues. For several reasons, I believe they're not applicable. Rule 69A says that it's the procedures of the state that are to be followed. The procedures obviously are that in the statute, Rule 2645. The state also wants to incorporate this broader public policy, but that appears to be inappropriate. When considering the procedures of the state, district courts must apply only those provisions of state law which specifically govern the enforcement of judgments. This state public policy, again, that had its genesis in the Root case, also in the 1800s, is broader than the enforcement of judgments. It concerns attachments of any assets held in the hands of the state. So for that reason, that public policy should not be applicable through Rule 69.
Would the LLC be able to sue the state if the state did not agree to the garnishment of the money?
Well, I believe following the proper adjudication of whether or not the LLC is an alter ego of Tao, that would be dispositive. And at that point, I believe that it would be no different than any other garnishment action, where any garnishee could be interested in filing suit against the entity that, that held the money previously. Unless there are any further questions, I ask that the court uphold the district court's decision.
Thank you. Mr. Brockman?
Thank you, Your Honor. Turning to Mr. Esther's last point first about the state's public policy and the suggestion that it should be ignored or disregarded. It would not be disregarded in state court. It should not be disregarded in federal court.
But it's not pertinent to the question of sovereign immunity.
Well, I thought insofar as it is perfectly aligned with the interests that underlie sovereign immunity. In Maryland, both are justified as grounded in public policy concerns. Both of them prevent the disruption of public affairs by, you know, getting drawn into the entanglement of, you know, tugs of war between private parties. So the cases that discuss the limitations on the attachment remedy as a public policy as distinguished from sovereign immunity do so only because it's much broader, so that it applies to public officials and municipal corporations that aren't entitled to assert sovereign immunity. Judge Hamilton, I wanted to just pick up your point about the Blue Fox Department of Army case. It is a recent reaffirmation of the Buchanan versus Alexander rule, and it applies to the federal government. It would apply in state court and in federal court, except where the federal government has waived its protection, as it's done, for instance, like child support under, I think it's Section 465. You can go into state court and get a federal employee's wages if it's for child support. But another case cited in our brief is the automatic sprinkler case in the Seventh Circuit, where the same argument made by Mr. Esters is made there, namely that the federal government really just didn't have that much of an interest in it. They had in the money, they admitted their indebtedness, and I think it was Judge Easterbrook said, that just doesn't cut much ice. The fact is, it comes from the Treasury, and all money in the Treasury is destined to go somewhere. I mean, occasionally we might be so lucky as to run a surplus, but it's seldom the case. We're paying back our creditors, our vendors, our contractors. We're providing benefits and services to citizens, some of them federal program recipients. And it is not federal policy to somehow override the limitations that are imposed through Rule 69 and through Maryland law. In fact, we've cited in our brief other circuits that have reaffirmed that state law restrictions do apply, even when it's the United States that is seeking to do the execution, as in
Brockman. Other than the fear of a default, which Mr. Esther says the court shouldn't really protect against the state's own negligence, as he put it. What further? And I realize that the mere naming, being named as a party, is, in your view, an indignity to the sovereignty of the state. Beyond that, you know, the need to answer. What else would happen to Maryland in this lawsuit if it were allowed to proceed with respect to its activities?
Well, as it is, we are now subject to multiple claims, one by the LLC and one by the judgment creditor. And we've had the money tied up for close to 3 years. We've been drawn into a dispute that, honestly, I see very little prospect of ending soon. There are very complex jurisdictional questions about whether the LLC can be, whether the district court can exercise jurisdiction.
But that's not your fight.
As the district court said, page 90, we're an innocent bystander to that. But we are innocent, which is why we shouldn't have to be a bystander. And that's, I think, what sovereign immunity protects for us, and Maryland's limitations on the scope of the attachment remedy protect us from being drawn into those kinds of disputes. Judge Duncan, I just wanted to respond to your question about waiver. The waiver in the statute that allows garnishment of wages of state employees does not apply here, and I think Your Honor is right to suggest that the existence of an express waiver suggests that no other waiver is intended. None is intended. None would meet the Atascadero stringent test, and even where there's a waiver, it has to be clear that the waiver is both as to suability and to the place where it's sued. That is, it has to make clear that we're opening ourselves to suit in federal court. Unless there are further questions.
Thank you very much. We will come down, greet counsel, and proceed directly to our last case.